The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So one of my friends said he thinks of retreats like a little bit like a cruise, sort of like a, and this is the entertainment portion, you know, even though it's probably not going to be super entertaining, but it's what we've got, so... Anyway, it's been delight to practice with you and hear you and talk to you in practice discussions and it's always I always feel inspired in hearing people and hearing about their lives, your lives, and it inspires me to practice more deeply. So we usually think about enlightenment as that which solves our problems. You know, it's like that. If we had that, our problems would be solved. Yeah. But maybe it's like reversed. Maybe it's more like. When we have no problems, enlightenment arises. Now, what on earth would it mean to have no problems? Yeah, it certainly doesn't mean to condone the kind of injustice and oppression of the world or. The needless suffering that is writ large. But it might mean in this moment not to have friction with experience. Like to begin to relate to phenomena as it's arising with less and less friction. And so we can't suspend the first noble truth that there is suffering, but we can become increasingly refined in our relationship to phenomena, in reducing the amount of friction that we have. And one of the effects of that is the mind gathers. The mind begins to gather, samadhi, the theme that we started the day with, the unification of the attention. So, in the same way, we tend to think about getting concentration, and that will make us happy, but in a... The parallels, the first example, it's a little bit the reverse. It's actually like we get happy enough and the mind gathers around that. We feel satisfied enough, even with the imperfection of the moment, that the mind starts to gather. The mind starts to unify. Now, in a sense, the opposite of samadhi is really, we think of it as sort of scatteredness, but for me, it's more like a kind of restlessness, a kind of restless hunger for some other experience. Yeah. And that restlessness is said not to fade. Like, that is like very deeply woven into our biology. It's said not to fade until we're quite free. Like, that restlessness, a subtle kind of restlessness, a subtle leaning forward into the next moment, that's kind of with us real far into this path, yeah. And some of this is a function just of, I think, of our human evolutionary conditioning. And some of it is probably potentiated by certain cultural factors right now, yeah? And so, not to badmouth technology while I'm in Silicon Valley, and I have a lot of affection for a lot of people in the room, and a lot of you are in tech. But... as has been noted, like when in an engagement-based model, you know, where sort of like valuation of a company of stock or something is correlated with time on screen, that creates a kind of incentive structure to make us as compulsive as possible. And, you know, like all the engineers, the software engineers, they're smarter than me, you know, and they're going to win. Yeah? It's like, this like most like basic commodity of like our attention, which at some level is like, yeah, it is the most basic commodity a human has in a way. That is you know, increasingly under threat in a way. And, and this is not, of course, not to discount like the enormous goodness that arises out of technological advancement. Or I'm not being dismissive at all. I just know that I don't have a super healthy relationship with my iPhone, you know, and this is a question of like the attention being hijacked and a certain kind of restlessness being reinforced, whereby we you know, we can just like reach out any time there's like even the slightest bit of restlessness to sort of soothe something in us, yeah? But it's like essentially like there's one intensity that's arising, and then we reach out to soothe that intensity with another intensity, with more stimulation. Whereas in Dharma practice, we are actually trying to meet and digest that hunger for stimulation in a direct way rather than feed it. And so as we practice, we're learning to, in a sense, ignore all of these kind of the urgent demands for attention as they arise, you know. It's like we sit down and there are so many different kinds of alarm bells going off of what we need to take care of and what we need to worry about. And we're actually learning to sort of drain the urgency out of those alarms. Yeah. And there's some research around the kind of restorative effects of nature and like what actually is happening at the attentional level when we're in nature. And one of the kind of hypotheses is that there's, because in nature we're not being confronted with like sudden urgent alarm bells pulling our attention, there's something restorative about that, that we can actually settle back and use kind of different aspects of our attentional system. And in meditation, I think we're learning to sit as if we were walking in nature, yeah. To actually begin to let go of the kind of the pull to respond to some of those alarms, so those that kind of sense of urgency. And so we notice how we're almost always waiting for something. You know? Like when you look at the level of attention, like in with some subtlety, there's this sense of even if we're actually quite present, there's this way in which we are leaning slightly forward to the promise of the next moment, to the promise of goodness, to the promise of concentration itself, yeah? And so we actually start to get like really sensitive to the way that we're sort of like of compulsively sandwiching ourselves between a past and a future. And we're trying to like subtly engineer one future rather than another. And it may not be very explicit kind of craving of I want this, I don't want that. But there's this kind of energy of leaning forward, of waiting for something, of waiting for our redemption. And what we're asked to do is to meditation is, there is an aspect of it that feels just like waiting, except we're not waiting for anything. Yeah. We're like poised, but we're not actually seeking refuge outside the moment. We're putting all of our hope into this moment. And it's so hard for us, you know, just like as a very, like very deeply conditioned to project ourselves into the future. It's so hard for us actually to find refuge here, you know. But sometimes the thought, like actually in the series of death contemplations, mortality reflections, you know, one might imagine oneself that one's life ends at the end of today or the end of this sit or at the end of this breath or something. And part of the value of that, there's a lot of value in that, in meeting these kind of deep existential questions and concerns. But part of the value of that is like, what would it be like to live in this moment if there were no future? Yeah. How would we settle in? What would we let go of? in what way would the mind just gather deeply around what's here? Samadhi is so it's so healing and such a refuge, and comes with such a sense of a kind of inner safety and strength. And that's so helpful, like as we seek refuge, as we seek shelter from the storm, you know? The kind of bombardment, the intensity of being human, the intensity of like this nervous system that's so sensitive and just wanting to like turn the dial down a bit. And one of the functions of samadhi is to turn the dial down. And it's like, it feels like less and less is actually arising. As a philosophy, the Buddhist philosophy, psychology, it's quite useful, but it's really actually samadhi that transforms it into a path. You know, without the kind of gathering of the mind, the Buddhist philosophy is sort of a set of ideas, but it's really in the kind of synergy of these ideas and this cultivation of awareness that it becomes this like very vibrant, rich possibility. Now, the kind of impediment that most of us see with in relation to samadhi is the compulsivity of narration, discursive thinking, mostly like verbal, but also visual, you know, thinking. And, you know, we meditators are almost like ashamed that we think, you know, like, you know, that like kind of like sense of like, I'm with the breath, right? There's the whatever fantasy number 720, you know, and then, okay, we catch ourselves, right? And then there's like that kind of like shameful return to the breath, you know. Like just sort of like head down, just, oh, okay, you know, like back, right? And it's like, you know, that whole process of getting lost, of course, is totally ensconced in unconsciousness. It doesn't even make sense to blame ourselves for something that we're not consciously in have any control over. And so we don't want to develop a sense of like our thinking as the enemy at all. But we want to see how deeply we hold out like hope in the redemptive potential of thinking. In a certain way, it's like we don't know how to hope in any other way than to think. Yeah. And so naturally we try to think our way to samadhi, to think our way to freedom, to think our way to happiness, because we're so used to that being like the mechanism for solving problems of being human. And the stories we tell in our practice become increasing, you know, the Dharma in a sense is a story. And the stories we tell about our life, our autobiography, they become more and more empowering and nuanced and wise. But even Dharma stories are ultimately unsatisfying. They can't insulate us against the tides of pleasure and pain. The Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman said, who did work on like cognitive bias and cognitive frames, said, nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it. Yeah? That makes sense? Right? Like the default assumption, like that, like when thought is a, when we're identified with thought, when we're living in that thought, it really matters, you know? Like they're all kind of, all our thoughts are a little bit brilliant. Like even the pedestrian ones of I should get ice cream, like yeah. That is brilliant too, you know? And, or, you know, a million, yeah? And so, you know, when we actually start to get more and more quiet, we can have this sense that the urge to tell stories, to narrate our life, runs really deeply. And to actually surrender the compulsion to fit our experience into a narrative, into a story of me and my future, to actually relinquish that is a very vulnerable thing. It's actually like leaves us feeling quite defenseless. And as we get more and more quiet, there can even be like this sense of terror in not speaking to ourselves about our experience. Yeah. That normally is quite remote, like we don't sense that, but but when we start to like really tune in to what it's like to be just wordlessly with experience, what it's like to actually not narrate our life, there can be a real fear, yeah, terror even. And so we start to get the sense like, okay, this thinking is actually very much bound up with staying safe, you know? It's like tracking the threats and opportunities at all times. And if we don't have our thoughts to track that, we feel defenseless. And so part of this kind of journey into settling, into samadhi, is actually beginning to feel more and more safe without our words. It's like the further we get from our kind of like homeostatic baseline, the further we get like somatically from like the baseline of just sort of like relatively peaceful or pleasant, the further we get from that baseline, either positively or negatively, the more energy there is to like explain that state to ourselves. Yeah. Does that make sense? It's like we can't experience intensity without being alarmed by it in a certain way. And part of our meditative path is actually training ourselves to surf more and more intense states wordlessly. Yeah. like to feel safe, for our inner life to feel safe without having to narrate our experience moment by moment. And in this way, we're really we're bringing that intensity, that experience to a sense of completion. You know, it's like our thinking is an attempt to kind of digest it, metabolize it, but there's a different kind of completion that happens when we can just be with the intensity at the level of the body, to actually ride that in a way. So, one of the main kind of functions I feel of samadhi in our practice is that it gives us confidence in our minds and confidence in the path. You know, like before we really settle in, the path might make sense and it might seem kind of intuitively useful. But there's a way in which when we actually really start to get quiet, that we realize we've sort of like underestimated the capacity of our mind. And we've been maybe practicing a little bit on borrowed faith. Yeah. But then we actually, you know, like I remember this with one yogi who's like, she was really, I don't know, there's just a lot of self-doubt. And then she went on retreat and came back, you know, and came back. And one of the kind of like the upshots of it for her was like, oh, I can do this, you know, like this is actually a real path. Yeah. I didn't know that my mind could gather in that way. I didn't know that I could feel that way inside. Yeah. So, different ways of describing samadhi. One of my main teachers, Shinzen Young, said, talked about it as basically like attending to whatever, the capacity to attend to whatever we deem is relevant. Yeah. And we usually think about concentration being very narrowly focused, and so the focus space is the tip of the nose or something. But concentration has many flavors. It's not necessarily a narrow focus. It can be very expansive focus. It can be with kind of more steady objects, or kanika samadhi, like momentary samadhi, that is very much a part of mindfulness practice. So, sometimes when we practice mindfulness, we can have the sense of the attention's being bounced around like a pinball too, you know, kind of fast and never soaking in. But part of the samadhi component of mindfulness practice is to actually soak the awareness into those objects moment by moment. So there's actually a sense of, we may be moving from, you know, a thought to a feeling to some other sensation, and that may be happening in a kind of continuous way, but there's a sense of like actually deeply connecting, rubbing against the phenomena so that it actually feels like the mind is soaking into that object, yeah, rather than grazing off the surface of things. And in this way, mindfulness can actually feel very much like concentration kind of practice. The Buddha in this front was like, said, there's no deep samadhi without wisdom. There's no wisdom without deep samadhi. But for one with deep samadhi and wisdom, they're in the presence of Nibbana. It was one of the lines from the Dhammapada, to actually acknowledge the union of samadhi and wisdom. Yeah. So the kind of some of the distinctions that we make in practice of mindfulness practice or concentration, you know, absorption, jhana practice, some of those distinctions are useful. And as Shinzen suggests, like concentration actually is a component of mindfulness itself. And if concentration is not a component of mindfulness, it becomes, we're just sort of like glancing off the objects of attention without soaking in more deeply. Now, some people get worried about getting attached to concentration. Like as Buddhists, we're sort of like almost paranoid of attachment, you know? We're kind of a little hypervigilant around, like, if we even start enjoying something a little bit, you know, that feel like we're like, well, I don't want to get attached, you know? So I would just like hold things at arm's distance or whatever. But you're going to get attached anyway, so just give up the vigilance. And sometimes it's actually important to like go through the cycles of getting attached and letting go. Yeah. There are kind of like horror stories from the tradition where somebody got like super attached to something. Like Joseph Goldstein tells a famous story where he's like, you know, young and in India, and practice was really cooking, and he just could sit for hours and hours, and he described a kind of body of light, you know, just like real, just bliss. And then he ran out of money and needed to go back to the States to make some money to get back to India, and his body of light. And he goes, he makes money, he flies back, he's ready to get back to business, you know. And he said, instead of a body of light, it was a body of twisted steel, you know. And he said he spent like 2 years trying to get back that sense of the unification of mind and that pleasure and bliss, yeah. And I had a friend who I practiced with who, you know, he said that his practice always seemed kind of conflicted. And at some point he disclosed to me after some years of knowing him that 35 years previously he had this experience in his backyard. And every time he practiced, he was trying to get back there, yeah? And it's like really kind of tragic, you know? But I sort of think of Joseph and my friend having suffered so that we don't have to, you know? We don't have to do that, yeah? And plus, like, you can't engineer. Samadhi is the fruit of letting go, yeah? And so to introduce another layer of clinging into the mix is not helpful, yeah? So just a few things before we close. It's interesting. It's like I've done a very poor time management job on my talk today, and that is it's a function of just like what's in the field, that like as in like, okay, I sort of like wind up slowing down or speeding up depending on what's happening. And I think like, oh yeah, we've all been sitting all day, and that I'm like moving things through things more slowly. So anyway, you're getting half of a talk. yeah. Thank goodness for that money back guarantee at YMCA, you know, that for all events. So, so a few things. So just like, okay, how is this cultivated? It's a function of many different conditions. Yeah, letting go being one of them. It's like Suzuki Roshi said something like, just to be alive is enough, you know? And that's kind of the attitude that I take into my heart in that kind of this kind of practice. Like, okay, just this is enough. And so there is this very active relinquishment of the gaining mind, yeah? Of even concentration as a kind of goal that we're assessing our relation to compulsively. Patience and perseverance. An acknowledgement that our intention, our will, is not the only factor. Yeah? Like there can be that sense, do you know when you sit down and you're like, I'm going to get concentrated, you know? And then maybe it doesn't totally happen and we're like, I'm going to try fucking harder, you know? You know? And it's like we put like all the pressure on our willfulness and it's just like, all right, I'm going to, now I'm serious, you know? Like, I can't tell you how many sits I've had where I'm basically like, no, I'm serious, you know, like, right? But what is actually the place of will in this? There is this kind of like, there is a certain kind of energy that's required, virya, like a sense of a willingness to invest energy, to be gentle but very intent on what we're doing. But that actual sense of like the will as located up in the kind of headquarters control tower of self, and that's what's actually pulling the levers, that's really just actually more thinking arising, yeah? And Ajahn Brahm made a very kind of eloquent point here. Says, stillness means lack of movement. Since will causes the mind to move, to experience stillness one must remove all will, all doing, all control. If you grasp a leaf on a tree and try your hardest to hold it still, no matter how hard you try, you will never succeed. There will always be some vibration caused by slight tremors in your muscles. However, if you don't touch the leaf and just protect it from the breeze, the leaf comes to a natural state of stillness. gives a very nice kind of flavor of this, the path of letting go, of relaxation, of relinquishing the kind of hope of finally bringing samsara under our control. Of making ourselves something, anything in the next moment. Of finding a refuge in pleasure, the absence of pain. We let it go. We protect the leaf from the breeze, but don't try to hold it still. So, offer those thoughts for your consideration, and as always, please pick up whatever is useful, and leave the rest behind. So, let's just sit for a moment together before we close. Just sensing whatever goodness is present in the field here together, and coming together this way of practicing, just letting go, gathering of the mind, practicing kindness, and cultivating safety and offering safety for our fellow practitioners. Whatever goodness is in you, may it overflow from your heart into your life, the lives you touch. And be a true cause for less suffering, more joy. Thank you. Thanks for your... we made it. Thanks. You know, like on residential retreats, everyone knows that the first day is just terrible. But that's all we had today, right? But we, like, did it. And, yeah, it's nice to be with you. And yeah, if you wish to support the IMC or support me, your donations are appreciated. Do we vacuum, Cheryl? Do we a couple volunteers? Yeah, or what do we need?
Nice to have bathrooms. So that's 3-6 people would be great, if possible.
Okay. If you have, you know, 10 minutes to volunteer, we can meet up here, and. And if anybody wants to chat or have questions, I'll hang around for a while. Happy to talk. And yeah, I appreciate the chance to speak with a handful of you. And yeah, may you be well.